Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you all to the first lecture in the Fall 1999 University Libraries Colloquia Series. This semester, all our presenters will be focusing on the future and the issues facing us in the new millennium. I hope you'll attend the other lectures in the series, which are listed on this flyer at the front of the room, so please pick one up as you leave. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Professor Michael Schechter of James Madison College. Professor Schechter received his PhD from Columbia University and has taught at MSU for more than 20 years. He's an active scholar in the field of global governance. In the last 2 years alone, he has edited 3 books, Future Multilateralism, Innovation in Multilateralism, and The Revival of Civil Society, and has also authored a 4th book, The Historical Dictionary of International Organizations. In addition, the consistent excellence of his teaching has been recognized with several awards over the years. These include the MSU Teacher Scholar Award, the Outstanding Faculty Award from MSU Senior Class Council, the State of Michigan Teaching Excellence Award, and the Quality in Undergraduate Teaching Award from the MSU Alumni Club of Michigan. He'll be speaking today on the future of global governance, public policy challenges of the 21st century. Please welcome Professor Schechter.
Well, when I was asked to come and talk on a series in the futures, because the innovation this year was that there was going to be a common theme, I initially balked at the idea. And I balked at the idea not simply as all faculty would because we don't have enough time, but because I was first trained as an undergraduate at Wisconsin and Madison in the height of the behavioral revolution. And one thing we good political scientists was taught is that you never talk about the future. I then went to graduate school at Columbia, which actually believed, which was actually the haven of anti-behavioralism, and believed in policy-relevant research, and thought that you really only describe the present and try to analyze that. And since I've been teaching at Michigan State, among other things in the field of international relations, I've been following critical theory literature, which tries to convince us that you should never focus on the immediate future, but only on the long durée, as they talk about it. And they have a real disdain for what's problem-solving theory. So actually, I thought that that was probably a problem to talk about the future in the immediate term, but I agreed to do that. I was then asked, actually, for original topic was to talk about the future of world government. And there's where I put my foot down. And I said, no, that would be a very brief talk. That instead I would talk about the future of global governance rather than the future of world government, and that was agreed to. I suggest that among the key questions that we need to think about on the eve of the 21st century are questions related to what I call public policy or global policy questions. Who rules? Whose rules? What rules? What kind of rules? At what level? In what form? Who decides, on what basis? My answers are related to what has come to be known as global governance. I chose to speak, I said, about global governance rather than world government, even though I think it's fair to say world government is a clearer concept and a more familiar term. I do this even though I think among the strongest critics of global governance are people who are world federalists who believe in world government. But I really didn't want to talk about world government because I don't think it's going to arrive in any meaningful way in my lifetime, nor actually do I think it's an ideal worth striving for. I also speak about global governance instead of international organizations, even though, as you heard in the introduction, I recently completed a book that dealt with the history of international organizations. I do that because I'm going to argue that I don't believe international organizations as they exist at this time will be up to the task of the 21st century, nor do I really believe there's much hope that they'll be reformed in a way that will allow them to cope with the problems of the 21st century. That argument obviously will take a bit longer to make, and I'll turn to that a bit later in the lecture. So I want to stress here is that what applies to international organizations and world government is that we really are in some kind of transitionary phase now. What I would like to argue is we're in a transitionary phase from formal government structures, which include international organizations, to less formalized structures, which I'd like to call governance structures. Before I go a little further, though, I think I want to add what my utopia is, if I'm going to argue it's not world government. What is that utopia? I think the utopia would look a lot more like a more diverse world order than world government seems to imply. It would look like something with a series of what you might call macro societies, either large countries or group of countries, or what is in vogue to talk about alternative civilizations. Each of them that would have some kind of solidarity, each of them pursuing their own telos, each of which would coexist, but each of which would be able to have some kind of discourse which will allow them to talk to each other, but not necessarily a conciliation of differences. So it would be a kind of set of macro societies which could converse with each other, which would maintain some kind of distinctiveness. I make this argument even though I know that there were those who argued that we were at the verge of the end of history, which would look very different. I make this argument even though I know there are people who believe that we're on the verge of the clash of civilizations, which would also look very different. And I also make this argument even though I know my utopian version or vision is not about to come about. So thus, my focus for today is not going to be on my long-term preferences, but rather on what I see happening now and what I really think will happen in the 21st century. So what is global governance? What is the topic that I've chosen to talk about today? The first thing I need to make clear is that the concept of global governance is a contested term. It's both vague and contested. I serve on the editorial board of a journal called Global Governance, and I can assure you that even the board of editors don't know what the term means, and we spend a great deal of time arguing about it. But I'd also say that when I talk about what I consider global governance, when we ever see an article that fits that definition, people get excited and surprised. So how would I like to define global governance for these purposes? I would suggest that it's the sum of many ways that individuals and institutions, both public and private, manage their common affairs. It's a continuing process through which conflicting or diverse interests may be accommodated and cooperative action may be taken. Therefore, it includes both formal institutions and regimes empowered to enforce compliance, as well as informal arrangements that people and institutions either agreed to or perceived to be in their interests. So recognize that the definition encompasses intergovernmental organizations. It encompasses international non-governmental organizations, but it also, in effect, encompasses much more. So if you're thinking about what does global governance mean, I suggest that you need to build into your understanding the roles of non-governmental organizations, the role of what people might call grassroots movements, which are movements within individual countries, usually within individual communities, but which are now often linked by the internet and can actually communicate with each other about information, about strategies, about tactics, about oppositions. It includes multinational corporations. It includes social movements, both what I would call resistance or counter-hegemonic movements, but also, in effect, social movements that are more in tune with governmental preferences. It also includes what some people now call transnational advocacy networks, a network being something which is less well formalized than a social movement, something which includes linking together people, if you will, but not actually having any formal institution, people who are linked together, if you will, by communications patterns and by a particular normative preference. You might think about a group of indigenous peoples movements being linked together, perhaps as a network, transnational advocacy network. It also includes much more often studied intergovernmental organizations like the United Nations and NATO. What this perspective then argues is that the local locus of authority in the world is in the process of shifting its location in the context of both integration in the world at the same time as fragmentation in the world. So it's an argument that suggests that as, if you will, states combine in regional organizations, there is supranational decision-making occurring above state level, at the same time that there is fragmentation in which states are in effect eroding, as people like to put it, in which case there is subnational decision-making, be it by social movements, by community groups, by grassroots movements. Let me try an example to try and talk about how this transition is occurring, or the contrast that I make between international organizations and global governance. If you were to study how environmental decision-making was occurring in the 1970s, let's say, your focus might be on the Stockholm Conference, an ad hoc conference convened by the United Nations. It might, if you were sophisticated, include some non-governmental organizations like the Sierra Club. And it might even include the United Nations Environmental Program that was set up, where if you really got elaborate, you might build in some of the environmental aspects of other organizations, like the World Meteorological Organization or the World Bank, which got into the environmental movement, or the United Nations Development Program. But if you were to use a global governance approach to studying environmental problems, which I suggest you need to now and should in the future, it gets a lot messier, because now you would actually begin to investigate the roles of community advocacy groups. If you're trying to focus on how to use site nuclear power plants, you'd look at community groups. You'd look at environmental groups that are not transnational linked in any formal way. You would look at environmental groups and social movements. You'd look at what I would call, or what are often called, environmental resistance movements, which are never invited to attend UN conferences for reasons you might be able to figure out. So it would include a much larger panoply of actors. It would include a larger ideological perspective. And for my purposes, what's important, it was allowed you to begin to think about change in the international system and not simply management of the international system. And students of global governance are students who care about change. And I think that one of the arguments I want to make is that as we move towards the 21st century, we need to think about change agents and not simply agents that manage the existing world order. So obviously what I'm trying to suggest then is that this perspective makes research much more difficult. It makes research much more complicated. You have to look at many more actors. But it also allows us to begin to identify the sources of change and resistance to changes in the world. It also allows us to begin to identify the sort of actors that I believe might be able to deal with the global problems of the 21st century. Before going a little bit further, I ought to add a kind of footnote, critique, what I consider one of the strongest critiques of the global governance approach, one of the strongest criticisms of the global governance approach. I think in the name of keeping things open, as we social scientists like to say now, the global governance process, in effect, allows one to, or even encourages one, to avoid making ideological statements. It encourages one to avoid the appearance of being ethnocentric or techno-imperialistic. In other words, I would suggest the vagueness of the concept of global governance, or you might, if you wanted to be kinder, say the breadth and complexity of the concept of global governance, keeps one or allows one to avoid making controversial and contentious statements. So I think one of the real criticisms of global governance is it's a way to avoid controversy. It's a way to avoid ideological statements. And so I think that critique ought to be placed there. All right, why do I think the future rests with global governance rather than simply international organizations, something I spent a couple of decades doing research about? I would suggest that my own research and belief in the most realistic means for dealing with the problems of the global problems has followed a kind of similar path, research problems and my own research directions. I've gone from a focus on UN-related agencies to multilateralism, now to global governance. And let me explain the shifts in my thinking and also why If I had given this lecture 10 years ago, I might have said the future rests with creative international organizations, and now I say not only, or not merely, or perhaps not at all. First of all, there's a clear belief that the major international organizations of the early post-World War II period, those that were set up to maintain the Bretton Woods economic system, are now, in effect, incapable of dealing with the kinds of changes that confront the international system. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, were extraordinarily, they were set up to maintain a Bretton Woods system which had fixed parity system. That ended in the 70s. The bank and fund continued to exist, obviously, and they continued to have important impacts on the international system. But they now have lots of rivals and parallel organizations, both formal and informal, with which they aren't coordinated very well. And so they're not capable of dealing with the problems very effectively under the current structure. The same thing could be said, I think, for the United Nations. I mean, you could make an argument that says with the end of the Cold War, the UN has had a real difficulty and a real problem. The UN, and some people saw the end of the Cold War as the great hope for the UN. It was now going to be able to do what it was set out to be done, to do. And of course, it's not proven to do that. But it's not proven to do that for a series of reasons I'll talk about in a moment. But my real argument is it was not set out to be an agent of change. I mean, that's not what the UN was organized to be. Or at least it was not organized to be an agent of rapid change. It was, real purpose was to stabilize the international political system in the same way the Bretton Woods twins were supposed to stabilize the international economic system. The second reason for kind of abandoning a focus on international organizations has been a belief that the network of intergovernmental organizations that are currently in place, which were mostly established right at the end of World War II, are not adequate to meet the challenges of the 21st century, chiefly because those problems are subnational and transnational in nature. And the intergovernmental organizations are organized around state lines, country lines. And many of them have constitutions that prohibit their involvement in the internal affairs of member countries, or at least prohibit it without the permission of those member countries. Moreover, many of those intergovernmental organizations have as their major employees bureaucrats who are committed to thinking along statist lines, who think along the lines of the fact that the purpose of international organizations is not to get involved in the internal affairs of member countries. Even if you read the constitutions of the organizations that you know get most involved in internal affairs of member countries, like the Bretton Woods twins, read their constitution someday and discover, in effect, they're doing things that they are constitutionally prohibited from doing. The easiest example, obviously, of this might deal with the difficulty of intergovernmental organizations dealing with civil wars and internal wars, the kinds of wars that plagued the world in the post-Cold War period. The kinds of wars where civilian casualties largely outnumber military casualties. If you think about the conflict in Kosovo, clearly for NATO and for the UN to get involved in there, they both had to violate their constitutions. They both had to violate their constitutive documents. NATO, in effect, operated where it is so-called out of area, where it shouldn't have. And the UN, of course, acted largely independent of the Security Council. In both of those instances, I could make an argument, a moral argument, and argue that somehow morality should trump the constitutions. I could make an argument that would even say that humanitarian assistance is evolving in international law, and so that at some point one might allow that to trump the constitutions. But those, in effect, are both stretching the point. The point I'm trying to make is that the United Nations is not supposed to, except in the rarest of instances, get involved in the internal affairs of member countries. Moreover, and perhaps more importantly, if they adhere to their constitutions and they do intervene in civil wars, they usually intervene long after the time when you would like them to have been there. You would have liked them to be conflict preventing not in effect trying to clean up after tens of thousands of people or thousands of people have been killed. That, of course, clearly means that an organization that is premised on respecting state boundaries has real difficulty with what we like to call early warning procedures, where you cite people within countries in advance so that they will share information so that you will intervene before the crisis occurs. There's clear evidence, for example, that people knew about the Somalian problems long before the real catastrophe of Somalia occurred. But it was difficult, if not impossible, for the organizations to figure out a way to get involved internally within Somalia. In addition, non-governmental organizations that were operating within Somalia found it impolitic at best to share that information broadly before the catastrophe occurred for fear that they wouldn't be invited back in. So global governance tries to get us to think about the ways in which state boundaries can be further eroded, if you will, to cope with the problems that confront us in the 21st century. And I'm suggesting intergovernmentalizations have that fundamental problem. A third thing I would argue is that I guess over a period of time, I've decided that most of the key international organizations that could deal with global problems have been unwilling or perhaps incapable of significant reform. So one of the arguments you could make is, all right, you've convinced me that international organizations as they exist can't deal with the problems of the 21st century, but why have you given up on their ability to reform themselves in some fairly dramatic way? And I just want to tick off a few of my reasons for being resigned, and I'm willing, of course, to be persuaded I'm wrong on each of these. If you start with the United Nations system, and I'll just, in no apparent, no obvious order, think about parts of the UN that people talk about reforming that seem to be interminable in their ability to reform. One of those, of course, is the Economic and Social Council. ECOSOC, which is supposed to coordinate economic and technical activities of the United Nations, a body that in some ways was enlarged too much many years ago to be an effective decision-making body, but is too small to be representative of all countries in the world. But more importantly, it has been a hindrance in economic and technical assistance problems. If we think about UNESCO, which has spent a good deal of time trying to reform itself to try and win back the allegiance of the United States. You could argue it clearly has failed if that's its task. But more importantly, it is not dealing with, at the highest level, the kinds of problems. So it's a kind of organization that's gone through a lot of reforms. But if the measure of reform is it able to get the allegiance of critical actors, the argument it hasn't made that yet. You could think about the UN in general, where in fact, even with a Secretary General hand-chosen by the United States in a very peculiar way, it's been unable, of course, to get the US to pay back its debt. But the consequence of that, of course, is that the US has lost whatever influence it still had in the UN. The consequence of that, of course, is that it convinces the members of Congress that they're right, that in fact the UN isn't worth supporting. So the UN actually is a very dismal place to be around talking to people at now. If you think about the proposals to reform the Security Council, most of them focus on adding new members, either as full members or as partial members. Most of those new members are advanced, industrialized, rich countries. The lists usually start with Japan and Germany, and then might add in some other countries, and that argument is easy to make, but it's not a way to legitimize the Security Council in the eyes of the people around the world, since the bulk of humanity have some reservations to start with. If you talk about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, one of the things that's happened to both of those organizations over the last 10 or 15 years is that they have massive duplication now, since both of them have decided that kind of mid-range loans are appropriate, conditionality is appropriate. And so the organizations have not been able to reform in any significant way the duplication. Even if you talk about my favorite part of the UN system, which is a trusteeship council, a body that, of course, has had nothing to do for a decade or more, in fact, nothing significant to do for quite a while. The trusteeship council people have come up with clever things to figure out what it could do. They said maybe the trusteeship council should become the trustee for the global commons. Which is actually an interesting idea. If you can't abolish an organization, give it a wholly new function, and which I think is creative. And you could actually argue that if that had gotten any headway, then the UN might have actually had a role to play with important issues in the 21st century, which the global commons certainly are. But of course, that went nowhere at all. But even if we talk about other organizations like NATO, I think it's clear that NATO has a problem with reforming itself in terms of its strategic doctrine. It's clearly been unable to effectively deal with the addition of new members. It obviously continues to have a problem with the notion of American dominance and what that means in its military and civilian leadership, clearly contributing to European wariness about the organization. If we talk about regional organizations, like the Organization of American States or ECOWAS, we discover that they continue to be dominated by a single country and therefore have difficulty, if you will, doing legitimate work in the security field. If you think about other regional organizations, the Arab League, the Organization of African Unity, organizations which actually could have an important role in dealing with civil wars, we discover that those organizations have historically been precluded from dealing with internal affairs of countries. And when they try to, they don't get very far or very effectively. Even if you talk about the European Union, which clearly has been able to overcome what people used to call the sclerosis of the 1980s, which is kind of a term that those of us who are aging don't particularly like. But even if you argue that it overcame the sclerosis of the 80s, it clearly has not been able to develop an independent foreign policy or an independent security policy, most clearly exemplified by its actions in the former Yugoslavia or in the Gulf War. So clearly my argument is that major reforms have been a problem in international organizations, and I don't see that changing. I'm not sure that Marie-Claude Smoots is right in arguing that they intentionally can't reform, that the only reform they can do is, I mean, their whole object is to pretend to reform. Her argument is that that's really the purpose, because that'll keep people interested, but in effect they can't reform. Well, they obviously can't reform in any significant way. I also have, in effect, turned from internationalizations because, of course, what I already alluded to, that many of them have begun to lose their legitimacy in the eyes of the vast majority of governments in which they work. The Security Council is a clear example, particularly the aftermath of the Gulf War. But you could talk about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the kind of conditionality programs that they've operated. Which some argue have led to the growth of non-democratic opposition in those countries. Some would argue that it's led to co-option of non-government organizations by those organizations. But clearly my point is that there's a legitimacy problem. Finally, I would argue that internationalizations, there are institutional inadequacies to deal with many of the contemporary public policy problems that are key to the 21st century. One which I won't discuss at length because Barry is the expert on this, deals with refugee questions. It's clear to me, at least, as a novice in that field, that political refugee questions are not adequately dealt with by international organizations in the sense of what I would consider ongoing permanent organizations with regular budgets that allow organizations to deal with a problem that by this point in our history we have to know is not going away. And so the whole notion of, in effect, relying largely on voluntary contributions when massive refugee problems arise is not an adequate way to deal with one of the key problems of the 21st century. The question of economic refugees, of course, is even a larger problem because not only does international law have difficulty with it, but internationalizations have difficulty with it. And probably the more important problem in some ways of the 21st century are internally displaced peoples. which confronts precisely my concern about how do you involve yourself with the internal dynamics of states. So that if the UN agencies are at least constitutionally precluded from doing that except in the most unusual circumstances, then major problems that confront the world in the 21st century can't be dealt with. If you talk about transnational criminal activities, if we care about drug trafficking, money laundering, trade in animal or even human body parts, which are clearly issues on the agenda of the 21st century. In fact, some make strong arguments that the major beneficiaries of economic globalization, the major beneficiaries of the growth of the internet, are actually transnational criminal activities, where funds can be transferred electronically, instantaneously. Communication is simple. One doesn't need to worry about having a Swiss bank account anymore. It's clear that organizations like Interpol are incapable of dealing with those proliferating problems for the 21st century. I won't even discuss the little bit that the UN does in dealing with issues like this. If we talk about environmental and ecological threats, whether we're talking about global warming, or if we're talking about alternatives to fossil fuel, if we're talking about preventing nuclear disasters, the reliance on ad hoc conferences that sometimes exclude some non-government organizations from the dialogue, if we talk about an underfunded United Nations Environment Program, these are problems that can't be confronted by the existing panoply of intergovernmental organizations. They're just not up to it. Sometimes they don't have enough economists on the board in their organizations in order to become credible with state governments. That can be persuaded more by economic reasoning. If we talk about world health pandemics, the World Health Organization proved in the AIDS pandemic that it had massive difficulty coping with a problem that didn't fit with its own institutional mandate. And the institutional mandate is to focus on health problems that confront all people in the world. So until it became clear that AIDS was a problem of everyone, the World Health Organization really opted out of dealing with that problem. If we have an organization which is dominated by physicians who believe that the discourse has to be medical and not social, if we believe that we can only deal with problems that are global, you won't be able to deal with many of the problems until they're much too late. And the WHO proved that. If we care about the issue of food maldistribution, another issue which clearly is a 21st century issue, we've discovered that the Food and Agriculture Organization, from its outset, has been unable to deal with this food storage problem, to deal with food maldistribution, largely for ideological reasons, which is to deal with food maldistributions, you have to interfere with the free market, and interfere with the free market in a way that major countries in charge of those organizations have always been uncomfortable with. If we talk about gender and racial discrimination, issues which clearly are on the agenda for the 21st century, we know that after four UN global conferences on women, that there is not yet a powerful international organization deal with gender questions. Whereas at the end of almost every ad hoc conference other than women's conferences, the only thing they can agree on is the establishment of a large institutional mechanism to try and carry out the activities. In the area of racial discrimination, the UN's record is even worse. It has spent the last 5 or 6 years repeatedly postponing even holding a conference on racial discrimination and racism for reasons that we might think we understand, which is it's a really tough issue to get countries around the table to talk about, but the issue of racism can't be dealt with if you can't even talk about it. And the UN eventually, maybe even next year, will hold such a conference, but they have been postponing it year after year since the United Nations agreed to do it 5 years ago. And finally, I would suggest, and here's something I've been doing some research on lately, if we talk about the diverse impacts of globalization, which often exacerbate economic stratification, which may obliterate, some would argue, cultural differences, which contribute to counter-hegemonic movements, including religious fundamentalism, perhaps in the Taliban's. We discovered that there really are no intergovernmental organizations that have been able to effectively respond to these impacts. In fact, there are examples of where intergovernmental organizations have themselves contributed to either the acceleration of globalization or some of the what I would call underside of globalization. Let me end my review of internationalizations on a more positive way. I think the other thing that's convinced me that international organizations are not the wave of the future is a realization that what the global communications revolution has done is that it's both contributed to the erosion of state sovereignty, as one of my colleagues at NATO likes to say, Fax Americana was able to do what Pax Americana was not able to do. The faxes were able to undermine the Soviet regime in a way that American strength was never able to do. Something of an oversimplification, but clearly a statement that technology is able to help erode national boundaries. But at the same time, I think the communications revolution has empowered otherwise marginalized peoples and movements. This is somewhat related to what Jim Rosenau likes to call the skills revolution. The skills revolution doesn't mean just that people in the 21st century will have better skills around the world, but more importantly, he argues that people's horizons will be broadened as a consequence of the communications revolution. They'll begin to recognize that there are global problems, and they'll begin to believe that they're empowered in ways to cope with them. And to me, the positive reason that's important is it allows one to begin to think about the fact that what I like to call bottom-up multilateralism, grassroots movements, may actually begin to be able to cope with problems that they weren't able to before. Because marginalized people around the world will now have the visions and the skills and perhaps the information necessary to deal with problems that affect their lives. Okay, let me turn to the question of how global governance tries to address some of these problems today. Since I've tried to argue that internationalizations can't do it, that internationalizations can't be reformed, and that the problems are multiple and persistent. I would suggest in simple declarative language, the global governance system of today is ad hoc, uncoordinated, duplicative, and largely undemocratic. It's probably hard to wonder why I am endorsing a mechanism that is ad hoc, uncoordinated, duplicative, and largely undemocratic. To put the best face on it, we are in a period of transition where we are slow to abandon state-based intergovernmentalizations, which were developed in the colonial era, that was more racist, more sexist, more ideologically divided, and fearful of a global Holocaust, and unconscious of the ecological decay than today's world is. So we have that kind of transition that's going on. But I think it's common to talk about the decay of the pillars of state sovereignty, or even to argue that boundaries are more permeable than they were in the past. But the dominant structures of global governance, which are intergovernmentalizations, I argue, fail to reflect those changes. They continue to act as if state boundaries are not permeable. They continue to act as if, in effect, the pillars of state sovereignty are still alive. If you followed my lecture to this point, I have suggested that they can't deal with the problems of the international system, that they haven't been able to reform themselves, and that the dominant members of those organizations are not willing to change it. So what we're witnessing, I suggest, is the evolution of a parallel structure in global governance that the intergovernmentalizations that are statist still exist, that those intergovernmentalizations have not entirely been abandoned, and in fact, they are neither being abandoned nor are they being reformed. I suggest that those intergovernmentalizations now sometimes work with new organizations. Sometimes they work for, the new organizations work for them, and sometimes I would suggest the new organizations work to undermine those pre-existing intergovernmentalizations. Let me give examples of each of those. If we focus on disaster relief or political refugees, I would suggest that we could find some examples of the old intergovernmentalizations working alongside these newer international, these newer agents of global governance. We would find that the UN works with state-based organizations, and they also work with some that are in the private sector. Traditionally, this has led to a criticism that the organizations overlap. The disaster relief has too many actors doing the same things, and it's a waste of human and financial resources. Some people make the same argument about refugee movements, that there are too many refugee actors operating, doing the same thing, wasting human and financial resources. The normal response to that criticism, that this is uncoordinated and duplicative, is that the net contribution is greater than if it were coordinated and it were a fewer number of organizations. In other words, the wastage is worth it, the argument goes. Yes, there's wastage in disaster relief, but the disaster requires lots more than you'd ever get if it were coordinated. Yes, there's wastage in duplication of political refugee movements, but in effect, that wastage is justified because the refugee movements need people to take care of resettlement in a variety of ways. But I think that the recent disaster in Turkey, for example, begins to evidence my suggestion about the need for a different approach to the disaster question. If what one had were a set of neutral observers who could have inspected buildings along potential fault lines, which are easy enough to identify, even if such inspectors, by uncovering potential danger, would have, in effect, raised criticism in Turkey, which would perhaps have deterred foreign investment in Turkey, that sort of model may be what we need to think about. And if you look at the outcome of Habitat II, one of those global ad hoc conferences that was convened, it in fact talks about empowering non-state actors to get involved in the internal affairs of member countries. So what I suggest is that in addition to, this is the alongside model, in addition to existing intergovernmental and non-governmentalizations, which are always worried about state boundaries, non-governmentalizations waiting to be invited in, intergovernmentalizations doing the same or having to wait for a crisis situation, we need to set up a mechanism which allows this kind of early warning before a crisis occurs. We all know that building inspectors in Turkey, for a series of reasons, including corruption, were unable or unwilling to inspect buildings, and they allowed buildings to be erected which were subcode. If we had a set of early warning actors who were able to go into countries to adhere, to check to see if codes are being adhered to, even if we're talking about in the United States, if you follow the logic of my argument, this has to be an even-handed approach. And if you're going to send inspectors into Turkey, they have to be allowed to go to California. And they have to go to California and say, these old buildings are a problem. Just like they go to Turkey and say, these buildings are a problem. You have to be able to play it in an even-handed way. Maybe it's a naive proposal, but in effect, it's what global governance is arguing, that as state boundaries begin to erode, one needs to be ready to exploit them. If all you do is modify the UN's activities, it's not going to happen because it's beyond the pale. The second model I talk about is a model where you've got non-governmentalizations working for intergovernmentalizations. And the UN, partly for financial reasons, has begun to do this. It's called subcontracting, is what the catchphrase is. The UN has gotten into subcontracting because it can't afford to do everything itself, so it presumably hires out or asks non-governizations to do activities for them. And this is even true in humanitarian assistance activities. Again, the consequences obviously result in an inefficient expenditure of financial resources. But I think more importantly, as the Bosnian case exemplifies, this kind of working relationship puts unrepresentative, undemocratic actors into roles that they can't adequately carry out. If NGO employees are shot at, for example, they have to rely on states or intergovernmental organizations to bail them out, or they just have to flee the situation. And how they act, where they act, and so forth, again, is not democratically controlled, which is of some concern to me. Again, this suggests the difficulty of conflict prevention, especially in internal conflicts, when relying on traditional statist institutions and the people they employ. In some ways, the most interesting example, though, I think, are examples of where intergovernmentalizations discover that other actors are working against them, that they, in effect, are breeding counter-hegemonic organizations. And one of the most interesting examples relate to indigenous peoples and their opposition to World Bank projects. These occur in a variety of countries. The most interesting country to me, actually, in this regard is in the Philippines, where in a deforestation project, we discover that the indigenous peoples allied with the local Communist Party. The local Philippine Communist Party had been trying to recruit indigenous peoples for a long time, were unsuccessful until the World Bank decided to build in hydroelectric plants, which bothered the people in the the indigenous people. And they eventually allied with the Philippine Communist Party, and to the point, actually, where they began to ally with the military wing of the Philippine Communist Party. Not shockingly, eventually, the World Bank withdrew from the project. But the same sort of counter-hegemonic opposition we would discover if we looked at environmental groups and women's movements in Mexico and the United States in relationship to NAFTA. So what this begins to indicate, I suggest, is a need to begin to work with different communities rather than unrepresentative governments. The Philippine case is a classic case where the World Bank did nothing wrong in the sense of not carrying out its logical mandate, which is it worked with the Philippine government, decided what the Philippines wanted, worked out a negotiation, and the problem was that the local community was not comfortable with that particular siting of hydroelectric power. The same thing would be true if we talked about deforestation projects. So what are, therefore, what are the key issues, then, that begin to arise from this experience with global governance that I've been talking about, the contemporary experience with global governance? The first thing that becomes obvious is there's a lack of democratic control. One of the problems with the evolving form of global governance is there's a lack of democratic control. And remember, I'm contrasting this with a statist model where states largely control the decision-making process, either as states or intergovernmentalizations. In that instance, there is a procedure which is much more often to be democratically controlled. But if we talk about, for example, key international economic decisions, who makes those now? Central bankers, who we all know are at nicest at arm's length from democratic control. But I think that they're more than any arm that I've ever seen. The people who attend the World Economic Forum in its annual meetings in Davos, who are often heads of multinational corporations, former elected officials, but no longer elected officials. You could talk about the Trilateral Commission. You could talk about the Appeals Board of the World Trade Organization. All of those are major actors in international economic decision making, none of whom is close to being democratically controlled or representative. In fact, you might argue the G7, the Group of Seven, at least looks closest to being a democratically elected set of bodies to deal with economic decisions. Is this a problem? Is there a problem that in an increasingly globalized economy, it seems to be that we are relying more and more on decision makers who lack responsibility and aren't transparent in their decision making? Is there a problem that there's a mixture between private and public actors? One of my colleagues works on bond agencies. All of you should be aware, without thinking deeply, about the impact of Moody's or something on the economic stability of particular countries. None of us has any control over those bond rating agencies. There is no control over, but they significantly affect whether countries' economies can borrow and at what rates they can borrow. Is there a problem with our economic decision making in this model of global governance, which gets us to build in bond agencies or the Davos meetings each year, in which there is no significant public impact? Does this kind of domination by the North, because most of these agencies, most of these people are from the rich, advanced, industrialized countries, ensure that there'll be an ongoing conflict between the rich and poor? Or is there some sort of mechanism that can be worked out that allows one to equilibrate in a better way than we have before? So the first question or issue that arises in contemporary global governance as we think forward to the 21st century is, what can we do to make it more democratic? What can we do to make it more responsive to the people whose lives it's affecting? The second is, I would argue that it's ad hoc. And ad hocery often leads to suboptimal decision making. For example, without a formal intergovernmental organization that exists, how are we going to deal with questions like global population or migration or natural resource maldistribution? How are we going to deal with the demographic shifts in which some countries are becoming, the people are becoming very old, and some countries have very young populations? Is there a way, in effect, to deal with this without relying on ad hoc conferences? And third, I would argue, and this has probably been my theme mostly, is that we're confronted with residual and inconsistent deference to state boundaries, which leads to accusations of bias of intergovernmental organizations. It prevents early warning mechanisms that are necessary, I suggest, to deal with natural disasters or nuclear disasters or refugee problems. And it precludes dealing with some of the critical issues like civil wars and internally displaced peoples. So what is the future of global governance? I suggest the model I want us to think about is what's called a model of subsidiarity. That's my best near-term prediction about what the global governance system is going to look like. What this means, I suggest, subsidiarity is a term that actually was identified with the European community, or European Union mostly. And what it means is decisions should be made at the lowest possible level. And what it really means is that decisions are made at multiple levels. Certain decisions need to be made at the supranational level, above the states. Certain decisions ought to be made at the community level. And what the European Union is committed to is making those decisions at the lowest possible level, the level closest to the people whose impact, who will be affected by them, which leads to my comment about representativeness or democracy or public control. The best near-term prediction, obviously, about what global governance will look like in the 21st century is that it'll look like much like the same. I mean, what does T plus one look like, time plus 1 year, is T. And so the easiest prediction is we're going to have the same problems I talked about. What that means is that I expect to see a continued erosion of the pillars of state sovereignty, that I expect to see a weakening of support for intergovernmental organizations that were established in the immediate post-World War II period. I expect to see calls for greater transparency and democracy in non-governmental organizations, so that NGOs are more transparent about where they get their money from and are more democratic. I could add as a footnote, ECOSOC a couple of years ago required that any organization, NGO, that wants to be accredited to ECOSOC now has to meet those criteria, which was not always true. I would suggest there will be a proliferation of social movements, some of which will be the establishment will contribute to, some of which otherwise will be funded, if you will, by state actors, and some of which will oppose the actions of states. And I would suggest that you might find a strengthening of what people like to call global civil society, especially with the use of the internet, which connects traditionally disconnected people, people sharing information about strategies and tactics. I would also suggest that there will be what people like to call a globalizing epistemic community, people who have specific knowledge-based communities where individuals become knowledge brokers, become people who have accumulated wisdom, and those people may lose their connection to particular nation states. I would also suggest there'll be an expansion of what I called earlier transnational advocacy networks, like the Women's Network, which grew out of the UN conference. It's probably the most important thing that had the world. Or the Working Council of Indigenous Peoples, an umbrella group. So the near term looks like the present. But I think the longer term suggests that this subsidiarity model will develop. And like I suggest, it comes from the European Communities model. For this to occur, however, obviously states and international organizations must be willing to relax their borders. Because one of the most statist remaining activities is international law. But it also means that some of the decisions I suggest will be supranational. You might think about military forces, a standing military force available for deployment in instances of civil war, or when genocide occurs, if you want to have a higher standard. Or perhaps it might require automatic taxation to help deal with redistribution, maldistribution of income or maldistribution of resources. There was a so-called Tobin tax, as people talk about it. Or it might even talk about a real tribunal to oversee global competition, something in effect to ensure some kind of free market. So you talk about both community decision-making and supranational decision-making. Global governance of the subsidiary type would presumably allow for communities to pace their development, allow them to elect, to encourage or discourage foreign investment, to allow them to encourage or discourage immigration. It's a model that would likely involve international regulation in places where it doesn't exist today, for example, child labor laws, including minimum ages to serve in the military, but it perhaps would also, which might make the United States unhappy if we had a rule that says you can't execute really young people, or maybe even execute anyone. But more importantly, it focuses us on decisions at different levels. But of course, remember the critique. This model finesses questions of power, ideology, and cultural difference. It acts as if those are not obstacles to international decision making. So let me conclude. In an era marked by shifting boundaries, by relocated authorities, by weakened states, by proliferating non-government organizations, social movements, transnational advocacy networks, and epistemic communities, at local, provincial, national, transnational, international, and global levels of the community, the time has come, I think, for us to confront the inefficiencies of our old ways of thinking, our old ways of talking, and our old ways of writing about government, and to focus on the weaknesses, the unreformability, and the perceived illegitimacy of the UN and other post-World War II intergovernmental organizations. The imperative, I think, is all the more important that we do this because of the shrinking social, economic, and political distances. As a consequence, I've called for a global governance approach, to global policymaking, especially a subsidiarity one. But I do so, I argue, knowing that the solutions to problems will continue to be suboptimally resolved as long as state actors remain central to the process of global governance. Okay. Questions? I'll be happy to take questions, corrections, remarks.
Can we go back to your idea of the utopian society that you were talking about? In what way are the alternative societies that you mentioned different from Huntington's clashing civilizations, which you seem to denominate?
Okay, I think the argument I'm trying to make is that Hunting assumed that you couldn't develop what some people like to call intersubjectivity, that you couldn't develop an ability to have a discourse for people across civilizations to communicate effectively. And I guess my utopian vision is that that's wrong, that you can maintain cultural difference without homogenization and without inevitable conflict. And so that's why I use the word utopian, because maybe it is naive.
But you're talking about the same actors as...
Well, I wouldn't talk about the same things he calls civilizations, as I'm sure you might not, since you know a lot more about Asia, I think, than Huntington does. But I'm talking about the fact that there are macro societies which are grouped together, perhaps, by culture. Because I do think there's an argument to talk about culture in a way that we have... international relations scholars particularly have not for a long time. That I think Huntington deserves credit for, which is reminding people that culture is more important in the 21st century, or will be in the 21st century than many people think about, and that clearly there is a problem with, for example, the United States not recognizing that communicating with certain societies is very different than communicating with other societies. That it's different to communicate with Germany than it is to communicate with the Taliban. And it doesn't mean that the Taliban are pretending to have, they come from a different belief system. So I think there is a lot to be said for that. But I guess where I differ is a belief that that discourse can't be engaged in. And I guess that by linking culture and military power, you in effect set up a barrier to that cultural discourse, which I think can happen. So I guess what I would want to do would be to study in a way how within societies cross-cultural communication succeeds in which there are very diverse cultural differences, and to try and see why that sort of sensitivity can't apply elsewhere. And if the answer is, well, there are power asymmetries, well, there are power asymmetries within societies. If the argument is that multiculturalism within societies don't always work, I understand all that. So I would also want to study the places where that cultural conflict within societies breaks down so that those errors are not transferred to the global level. Does that try to distinguish myself from Huntington a bit? But you're right. I do agree with Huntington that there is something to be said. I don't like the word civilizations, but there is something to be, because some of the things he calls civilizations are certainly not civilizations. But I do think there is something to be said for talking about culture. Okay, Ben?
Many authors have said described the rise of fundamentalism and nationalism in many parts of the world, including the West, which interestingly is occurring concurrently with improving communications technology, which many people would assume reduce rivalries and insularity. Do you see this as an obstacle
No, I think that I spent a lot of time trying to think about and do some writing about actually the impact of the internet on community building, okay? So-called virtual communities. And is one able to, does the internet in effect allow one to improve, or does it lead to conflict? And can it lead to, or insularity as you might call it? And I think the answer is it's a tool that's used for multiple purposes. And so I don't think it's, I mean, I think it's, I don't want to call it a neutral tool, but it's a tool that doesn't necessarily lead to homogenization. I mean, people who believe that cross-national communication or globalization means homogenization, much less cultural homogenization, are wrong. It leads sometimes to homogenization. Sometimes it leads to melding, if you will, or assimilation. Sometimes it leads to conflict. Sometimes it leads to resistance. I think you trace this out in literature perhaps as well as you can in anything else. So that I think that what the internet is doing is it's accelerating the sort of cross-cultural contact that has always occurred. And the consequences of that cross-cultural contact has always been multiple, in which you've got sometimes you've got a melding, sometimes you've got assimilation, sometimes you've got imperialism, if you will, and sometimes you've got massive reaction against it. The internet, I think, is an interesting question, because I used to think, well, the internet has the advantage of leading to masking who the audience is at the other end, you know, in terms of nationality, in terms of gender, in terms of race, and then it presumably had a lot of opportunity, not in terms of class, because I think there's a clear class difference as to who's using access to communications technologies, but the others it does. But I think the evidence suggests it's not that good at that. It's not as good at masking as it might have been. So the whole idea of building cross-cultural communities where, in fact, people would maybe not interpersonally get along well, but now that you know that person, you know, virtually is a different race, a different, doesn't work as well as people thought it would. The other question is, what is the essence of a community? Can a virtual community really be a community anyway? You know, if your purpose of a community is actually human interaction, working together, to solve problems, it only can go that far, I think, through communications technology. Is that okay, in the back?
Yeah, nice job on pointing out some interesting aspects about talking about global convergence. What I was wondering is, what do you thought in terms of in the future, what do you think will be the overall role in economic development in countries and societies around the world?
Okay, I think that I only quickly alluded to that question at the end by saying something like, I think the thing we need to begin to think about is alternative pacing of development processes. So that one can really think about, let's use the example I alluded to a few times, indigenous communities. I think that we need to think about mechanisms where communities actually can choose alternative paths of development. And that alternative path of development may actually be very unlike anything that the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or the USAID would have liked them to think about. And I think that's an argument for global governance, is an argument for saying state boundaries should not be the impermeable boundaries, but maybe community boundaries should be. Maybe the people within particular local communities know best about whether they, and in a book I recently edited on globalization, we had a couple of people in Central America do research on how different communities were reacting to globalization of the economy. And what you find is that some local communities embrace it, because here are people who've always been poor in their community. They really want to have access to an external market that they never could have before. Others clearly want to resist, you know, and that they would like to spend all their time developing a local market. So they want the strategies of marketing that they can learn from outside. They don't want to have anything to do with an external market because they believe it will result in all of a sudden tourist export goods instead of locally produced goods. And it's very interesting because when we think about globalization, whether it occurs or not, we think about state actors. And what becomes very important is municipal actors. You know, local communities embracing and reducing it. You know, there's a whole debate now about the local as important in the global. And I think that my argument would be in terms of economic development that the pattern would be more diverse than what I'm thinking about. There'd be many, many different models. There'd be different paces. There would be different things that would be emphasized. And the choices presumably would be made by the people whose lives are most affected. Now, that may all be naive, but it follows logically from what global governance is about, which is there's a problem with, it's not just did the IMF apply the same model to every country, because I think that's wrong. The IMF clearly has learned to be sensitive to individual different countries. But even so, they have a clear view that neoliberalism, as we call it, is the way to go. So even if you're sensitive to alternative governmental structures and culture, you're not really sensitive to the notion that this may be an economy that would be best served not being rapidly integrated into the global economy. So I think global governance would allow one to say those choices would now be open, at least. And that happens if you weaken intergovernmental organizations. If I can convince people to abandon not simply spending their lives researching them, but actually embracing and supporting them, then maybe there is some hope for that. Okay?
You talked quite a bit about the erosion of state boundaries. And that seems like it would be a fantastic sort of development, but at the end you talked about some other things, including this subsidiary model of governance, which sort of seems to imply more power at the state level. And I was wondering, sort of involving that and on a more general level, how you think that erosion of state boundaries will sort of happen.
Okay. The real argument people give is that, I mean, the major argument that the state boundaries, or the easiest argument about state boundaries eroding, is an argument that says, if we talk about where is economic decision making occurring now, it's not in the hands of national governments very much. It's much more in the hands of, be it international organizations, or be it these private bankers, or these bonding agencies, or be it private investors. I mean, there's more money going across in financial transfers on a daily basis, if you will, than the GNP of any country in the world. So clearly countries have lost control over their economic decision making. That's an easy argument to make. If you talk about human rights questions, something we haven't talked about very much, it's clear that countries are now being held to human rights standards that are not their own. Okay, and that in that sense, you can argue that there has now been an erosion of state boundaries. I mean, large numbers of countries would never on their own have decided that somehow the treatment of women equally to men is a proper standard to hold them up to, much less for financial aid, you know. Or if you talk about environmental questions, it's not just a question of ecological problems transcending national boundaries, which is easy. That argument has always been true. But in effect, all of a sudden, there are now standards that in order to trade, your goods, let's say, have to meet a certain kind of environmental set of standards. So therefore, you're being imposed on you from outside a set of decisions you never would have reached on your own. You know, so that's the erosion of state boundaries. Now, your question is, but doesn't my subsidiary model suggest that state boundaries still are important? Well, I mean, states still, I argue, in the near term will clearly be powerful. Do I want to empower states more? Well, that's where my problem was. Remember, I said my problem is that many of the other actors are less responsive to the people at the moment than states are. I mean, I actually have a problem with non-government organizations that are not transparent and have no public access to decision making. You know, even if in general NGOs are good, they're not all good. I mean, there are lots of NGOs that are evil. And I mean, you know, we try to think of only good ones, but we can give you tons of ones that are, and the major ones that are growing are not all good. And so the lack of responsiveness to that is what concerns me. So that's where I haven't abandoned states yet. I also think that I'm enough of I was trained, remember, as a political scientist who looks around the world and says, there may be an erosion of state boundaries, but states are still the most powerful actors in the international system and will be for the foreseeable future. Okay, question?
Just the transnational advocacy network alongside the UN, but rather they're quite sort of
Okay, well, I mean, it's not that I disagree with you that much. I actually have been working on, actually the latest thing I've been working on is actually an impact of, a book on the impact of global ad hoc conferences, including the Beijing conference, where Rebecca Cook has worked on that. And I don't disagree with the argument that ad hoc conferences, particularly the women's conference, have been very important in terms of a catalyst to the women's movement and to helping form networks, okay? I guess I was trying to argue, and I don't think it's dysfunctional. Some of the ad hoc conferences, I might argue, would be not an efficient expenditure of money. I think the women's conference is more effective, and the fourth is actually a fairer one to use. And we certainly go back to Mexico, and we would actually have a different statement, I think, about the effectiveness of Mexico as an ad hoc conference, whereas I think you go back to other ones. Nairobi might be more effective. I guess my argument would be I'm not throwing out international organizations entirely. I'm not throwing out ad hoc conferences particularly, because I think ad hoc conferences are not very different from informal mechanisms that to me are central. I'm bothered by the organizations that were set up in the immediate post-World War II period that have a structure of decision making which is at odds with what I think the world looks like at the end of the 20th century, and which have mandates that are not appropriate or at least sufficient for the current agenda. So I don't think I would abandon ad hoc conferences. In fact, the reason I wrote this book or got this book going is to try and say, if the ad hoc conferences are going to be convened again, you have to be able to prove that NGOs that they catalyzed have actually been able to carry out what their mandates are. You do better in the women's conference than you do with almost any of the other recent 1990s conference. Right. But if you look at the five-year review conferences for most of them, be it, you know, UNCED or whatever, you find out that most of them said nothing to really report yet. The nicest story you can say is it's only 5 years, what can you expect? But in actuality, there's very little follow-up work, partly because the states didn't live up to the agreements they made, in the sense, including empowering NGOs and providing money to. I mean, to me, one of the most interesting things of the 90s conferences, as contrast to the 70s conferences, is the 90s conferences explicitly say, we're going to empower NGOs and we're going to provide money to them. And that's almost in every document because the NGOs worked to do that. But if you look at what happens, in effect, it hasn't happened yet for a whole set of reasons. It hasn't happened. So I think, actually, I make an argument that the success of ad hoc conferences now is largely on the shoulders of NGOs. They haven't yet been able to carry out the mandates they're given. Women's movement is slightly different, although I think the real issue for me, and you know probably more about this than I do, but you know, the real issue, of course, is the North-South issue. Has the Beijing conference been able to effectively deal with the question of differences amongst women's groups? And as you know from the Beijing conference itself, there were lots of debates on there. I mean, read the criticism of Hillary Clinton's, you know, participation at that conference by women from the South. I'm not sure that out of the conference we've gotten that far on that issue, which is what I would call, to me, is the critical issue. It's the same cross-cultural question that interests me, which is a question of, can you get women from different positions in life really to learn from each other and to work with each other cross-nationally? It didn't work that well at Beijing. I haven't seen it work that well since then. Right. Well, historically, remember, the whole purpose of the conferences has been, the best thing for the conferences until these recent ones, is the anticipation of the conference. Remember, before the first women's conference, the Latin American countries all quickly raced to work on their constitutions because they knew that they had discriminatory constitutions and they were going to be called to task to show the fact. So they cleaned up. It doesn't solve the important problems of women, but at least it got rid of the formal discrimination against women. So I think that, you know, ad hoc conferences had a very useful impact, usually not, you're right, not during the conference, either prior to the conference or in the aftermath of the conference. Now it's largely the aftermath of the conference. And the women's movement network needed that. And you're right, it does legitimize it. Although I think if you look at what's happened in Russia, it hasn't been as effective in legitimizing the movement as they'd hoped it would be. There's been some follow-up work on the Russian conference where it actually in some ways delegitimized some of the women's movements, because historically the women's movements invited and participating are part of the state. You know, but again, I'm not disagreeing with you. It was a useful critique. Question. Well, I think I have more difference in less hierarchy, okay? If you ask me what's to be predicted, it might have, I mean, if you ask me what's more likely, a more hierarchical system as you talked about, or this utopia I have, I might be willing to say a more hierarchical system is more likely. But that's not my utopia, okay? My utopia is much more of a kind of, you know, less of a layered and more of a set of parallel macro societies interacting with each other and having a common discourse than it is a hierarchy. Hierarchies don't last that long.
No, they don't.
It was a different age. It had different sorts of leaders. It had different sorts of goals and ambitions. Yeah, and then there, but my problem is, because remember, I'm talking about a global model. That was not a global model. I mean, you know, so in a sense, although one might have thought about that as all there was, we clearly know that that's a Eurocentric view of the world. And so if I were thinking in a narrower perspective, I could envision a very different sort of world with a narrower set of cultural differences.
One of the problems is that much of the world is still in a nation-building state. And the nationalism that's driving that, it's going to be very hard to internalize in a sense globally.
I don't disagree with either of those statements. Either it's important or it's a great puzzle. And I think probably if I had a solution to that, I would have given it to you. Well, remember, I argue that one of the easiest critiques or best critiques against the global governance model is that it really doesn't have a clear ideological statement. It doesn't do very well with power differences. And I think to respond to your question, one would need to build in the question of power asymmetries. One would have to talk about the way in which power interacts with this kind of multiple layers, the way in which what it does say about ideology. It seems to imply a way in which the world is not ideologically contested. And I think that's probably not right at a certain level.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for your question.